Sarah Centillus broke up with the creator of the universe just as she was about to be ordained a priest in the Episcopal Church. She tells all in her book, Breaking Up with God, A Love Story. In this interview, Dr. Centillus shares her theological journey and demonstrates why, if the church is going to have any relevancy to educated and inquiring minds, it is going to need to challenge its patriarchy and its outdated images of God. Eugenie Scott was the executive director of the National Center for Science Education until 2014. In 2012, she was my guest to discuss the history of the evolution creationism controversy and promote the teaching of science. From the archives of Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net, I'm John Schack. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Schuck. In this episode, I take us back to 2012 for a rebroadcast of interviews with Sarah Centillus and Eugenie Scott. In the first part of today's show, you'll hear an interview that first aired in January 2012 with Sarah Centillus. Sarah Centillus broke up with God just as she was about to be ordained as a priest in the Episcopal Church. So she tells her story in her book, Breaking Up with God, A Love Story.
I grew up Catholic. My father is Catholic, and my mother grew up Episcopalian, but she converted to Catholicism when my parents got married. So I went to CCD, which is the Catholic version of Sunday school, and to Mass every Sunday. And I was puzzled by God as a kid, and I really was struggling to figure out what it meant to have this person in the sky who loved me, but also a person who was ready to punish me. And I really developed a sense of theology where God protected people that God loved. And so your challenge was to figure out how to get loved by God in order to keep yourself and the people that you love safe.
Okay. So was God a man? And did you pray? Did you talk to God back and forth?
I talked to God all the time. I don't think there was a back and forth. I did a lot of talking.
You did
the
talking.
I didn't hear much. Yeah, I did the talking. I tried to listen. And definitely God was a man in my imagination, in the liturgy, in the songs that we sang, in the images that I saw in church. God was definitely figured as a man, an old white man at that.
And then you went to college. You went to Yale University to study literature. And in your book, Breaking Up with God, you dressed in black and you read the French deconstructionists like Jacques Derrida. And what you learned is there are things that we think are real are constructed by our language, including God. Is that right? And more than
that's
that?
That's right. Yeah, I dressed in black mostly because I didn't want to have to do laundry, and I had this funny feeling that if I wore black all the time, people would think I had a lot of black clothes instead of just wearing the same black clothes all the time. But yeah, I studied deconstruction and started recognizing that meaning is something that we make. It's not something that we find or something somebody else can tell us about, but something that's constructed. And in deconstruction and in that kind of literary theory, people kind of fell into two camps. Those who thought that meant that was the end of meaning, that if meaning is something that we make, then really there's nothing, kind of a nihilism. And then those who thought, well, if meaning's something that we make, then we can make better meaning and we can figure out how to make the world a more just and life-giving place. And I think I fell into that second camp where recognizing that it was human beings who were making things, making literature, making art, making ethics, gave me a sense of freedom and exhilaration, and I wanted to participate in that work.
So when you were in college, you mentioned in your book that you were publicly kind of embarrassed about God. Yeah, I used to be religious, but privately you'd still pray. God was still personal and active for you in your life. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had this intellectual awakening going on, but personally, I still was holding on to that version of God who would protect me and protect the people I loved. It was kind of God as safety net, and I clung to that. It was a fear-based kind of clinging. I prayed out of habit. It was kind of automatic as breathing. But most of my prayers were about keeping people safe, about making sure people weren't sick. So that was the God in my imagination still at that time.
This is Religion for Life, and my guest is Sarah Centillis, and she is the author of the book Breaking Up with God, A Love Story. And after college, Sarah, you moved to Los Angeles to participate in the Teach for America program, teaching program working with poor students, and you found a church there in Pasadena that kind of helped you in terms of what you were doing in your work. All Saints Episcopal Church, is that right? A progressive church, and there you decided to become a priest. Tell me about that part of your life.
Sure. After I graduated from Yale, I did Teach for America, which is a program that I'm actually highly critical of for exactly the reasons of what my experience was like there. So I was 21 years old. I had no teaching experience. I had no kind of critical awareness about race or my own privilege or poverty. And I was sent to work in a school, an elementary school in Compton, California, which is in South Central LA. And the students I had were magnificent, really smart, really excited about learning. But my classroom had no books. The ceiling was falling down. There were mice and maggots crawling through the floor. We didn't have a playground. So it was this awakening for me to my own privilege and to the unequal school system in the United States. So in that context, my mom came to visit me, and she brought me to All Saints, Pasadena, to the Episcopal Church there. And I just fell madly in love. I fell madly in love with the church, with the version of God that was being talked about, with the social justice work that that place was doing. And inside me began to be this sense that I wanted to be a priest. I thought that churches could be places to fight injustice and oppression, and I wanted to participate in that.
Speaking on Skype with Sarah Centillis, author of the book Breaking Up with God, A Love Story. And you decided to go to seminary at Harvard Divinity School, and you decided that the red flag came up that even though you were studying to be a priest, you really didn't want to go to church. Why was that?
Well, it's funny because I think I was asked a very prescient question before I went to divinity school by one of the priests at All Saints, who asked, did I want to get ordained as an Episcopal priest in the church at large, or was it something about All Saints that made me want to get ordained? And at the time I said I wanted to be an Episcopal priest. It wasn't just All Saints. But once I arrived in Boston, I realized I really loved that particular church. I had a lot of trouble finding a church that felt like home, a church that used inclusive language, or churches that had women who were priests, or churches that were committed to fighting against homophobia or any other kinds of oppression. There were a lot of great churches, but they just didn't feel like home to me. And so I avoided it. I never went to church. I went to the library instead, or I went to yoga instead, and just pursued my love of theology. So I was falling in love with theology, with the study of the things that human beings have written about God, and my attention was drawn there instead.
So did you begin at that time to sense a gap between your personal understanding of God and what you were learning about God, your intellectual understanding of God? And was this, and this gap started to develop? Is that what happened? And then you kind of stopped praying to God? Was that the point you stopped doing that, or...
I don't think it's funny. I don't pray, but personally, I still do pray. It's like an instinct. I mean, even now where I don't call myself a Christian and I call myself an agnostic, prayer is something that comes to me. I say prayers of gratitude mostly. So my prayers mostly are thank you and please, 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 please. I mean, I think it's in my brain and in my language system, so I'm not sure it's something I can let go of, even if intellectually I don't believe in a God who can intervene in human affairs. But at this time, I read about it in the book that there was a chasm that was opening up between this intellectual understanding of God that I was getting at school, which was fabulous and expansive and beautiful and brilliant. And I was learning about all these possible ways to think about God. I was reading theologians, like, you know, historically, all different kinds of theologians. I was reading Karl Barth and Tillich and ancient theologians, and I was reading feminist theologians and black theologians and womanist theologians and liberation theologians. And I just thought, wow, there's more to God than I ever learned in church. And this is incredible. And I just felt on fire with that, with the love for that kind of knowledge. And then at the same time, I was recognizing that there was this difference between the kind of God that I was allowed to imagine in classrooms and the kind of God that I was being asked to believe in as a Christian in most churches in the United States. And I kept trying to stand across that chasm and to use my body as a kind of bridge, but it just widened as time went on.
And you found, and I'm speaking with Sarah Centillis, if you've just joining us. This is Religion for Life. I'm John Shuck, and my guest is the author of a book called Breaking Up with God, A Love Story. And at Harvard, you wrote that you took every class you could from Gordon Kaufman. And he died just this past year, just about the time, I think, that your book was released. And in the acknowledgments, you wrote to him, "Thanks to Gordon Kaufman, please know that this is a love letter to you, a thank you note." Do you know if he read your book or knew about it, or?
Yeah, I Gordon Kaufman has had the largest impact on my thinking, and I love him. I miss him terribly. He died in July. My book came out in June, and I just went to his memorial service, which was on Halloween in Harvard, in the Memorial Church there. And I do know that he read my book. I sent it to him to make sure that he would have a copy. And I talked to him on the telephone after I sent him a copy. And we talked about what I'd written and his thoughts about it. And he understood that he had Alzheimer's. He was losing his mind at that time. But he understood that the book was dedicated to him. And he understood that he had changed my life. And at the memorial service, when I went through the receiving line, his four kids were there, who aren't kids, they're adults now. And they said that my book is still on his dresser. So I know that he knew that he mattered to me, which gives me a sense of peace about not having him around anymore.
Because he was very important for you in helping you have permission, perhaps, is, I don't know if that's the right word, or have that sense of liberation that you use the image of the birdcage and the door that was open, and he helped to fly out of it.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my time at Divinity School, both in the master's program and in the doctoral program when I got a doctorate in theology, talking with Gordon in his office. He had a rocking chair, and he had an office in the basement of one of the buildings, and we talked a lot. And one of the things he would say is that people are in cages of their own making, and that part of his job was to show them the door was open and they were free to go. And I thought that he was talking about other Christians. I thought he was talking about Christians at the church where I ended up getting a job, where I entered the ordination process, or he was talking about other religious people at school. But I realized later that he was really talking about me, that I had entered a cage of my own making, that I was trying to fit myself into a theological system that no longer worked for me. And one of the gifts that he gave me is an understanding of theology as a constructive, imaginative, artistic practice, and an understanding of the theologian as committed to social justice. I mean, he kind of said, if you aren't writing theology that matters, if you aren't writing theology that makes the world a better place for humans, for the earth, and for animals, then you really aren't doing theology at all. And the other gift he gave me was an understanding of questioning and doubt as a faithful practice. I think that there are a lot of Christian communities where doubt is not allowed and questions aren't allowed. And he really help me see that questioning is a faithful practice when you understand that God is mystery. God is bigger than anything we can think or say about God.
What happened? You started work for a congregation in between your master's program and your doctoral program, and whereas All Saints Pasadena inspired you to enter into the ministry, it seems this church that you were working with kind of inspired you to leave it. Tell us about the day you broke up with God. What happened?
Well, it had been a, I guess if you're using the analogy of a breakup, it had been building for a long time, and I was having the sense that this wasn't the right relationship for me, but I kept pushing it. I kept trying to make myself fit in a situation that was not built for me. I mean, the church, I think a lot of the people in the church were uncomfortable with my politics and with the fact that I was a woman and with my theology, and I was definitely uncomfortable with the kind of God that was being talked about there, and there really wasn't much room for me. So they'd formed a discernment committee, and it was a group of people that was tasked with the job to figure out if God was calling me to be a priest. And it was a group of really kind, generous people, and they were comfortable with most parts of me. And I just kept trying to push them and piss them off a little bit. I had bumper stickers that were provocative on my car, and I was giving them the most radical forms of my theology that I could, and they really were fine with it. They were comfortable with it. But slowly they started suggesting that maybe I wasn't called to be a priest, that maybe if I was struggling so much with institutional religion, that maybe this wasn't the place for me. And I had trouble hearing them and hearing that suggestion. And we ended up having a blow up when they realized that I had moved in with my boyfriend at the time, and they just thought that was not appropriate thing for a minister to do, or a future minister. So at that point, I ended up dropping out of the ordination process, and I drove home. I knew after I left that meeting that it was over between me and the church, and I started thinking that it might be over with between me and God, at least the version of God that I'd grown up believing in.
You know, your book resonated with me as a minister who struggles with God and has left the personal God as well, even as I still use the concept liturgically. In fact, I often say the historical Jesus is my Ishtadeva, my chosen deity, even though I know it's all metaphor and projection. But I talk about these things with my church. But there's a sadness, I guess, when I read your story, and this is for selfish reasons alone, was that we lost a smart, compassionate, honest priest. So in the back of my head, I keep wondering, if you had had a better church experience, would you have stayed as a priest, or was this kind of a package deal?
That's such a generous question. Thank you for saying that. I do think it had to do with the church. I think that when I broke up with the church first, and I thought that meant that I could stay in relationship with God. But then when I've tried to find my way back into various religious communities, I realized that the metaphors that they're using don't work for me anymore. Mm-hmm. I think if I had had a more positive experience in a church, and a lot of my friends who are ministers have had a lot of way more positive experiences in churches, I think I might still be part of a church. And I think it's so brave that you're willing to share your own struggles with your congregation. I think if I'd been part of a church that had a minister that was willing to share his or her struggles, then I would have felt like there was more room for me. I think one of the things that a lot of churches do is to frame doubt as something that's supposed to be overcome. But if God is bigger than what we can understand God to be, then actually doubting and questioning is part of what it means to have faith. And if I'd been in a community where that was allowed, I think I probably would have stayed.
Yeah. Do you think Christianity is going to survive without a personal God?
I don't know. I thought that I could be a Christian without a personal God. But really, if you let go of that, the whole thing starts to unravel. Uh-huh. Although I would say that a lot of the people I know and love who consider themselves Christian don't believe in a personal God. But if you don't believe in a personal God, then you lose everything. You lose prayer. You lose worship in some sense. You lose, I don't know, it changes your understanding of who Jesus is. So I think a lot of Christianity hinges on a personal God, and I'm not sure what's left if you let go of that.
Yeah, I wrestle with that question pretty much every day, and how that works, and finding different ways to talk about it. I do think the idea of at least being honest and open and not knowing where we may end up having to go is okay. In fact, the idea, when you use the image of breaking up with God as though God is like a lover that you need to leave so that you can grow, and I know in talking with people about about that kind of thing, that people feel it's a kind of a tragic deal, you know, losing your faith, awful experience. But really, it isn't like that so much, is it? It's more of a liberation. I want to share with something in your book with listeners here. I'm speaking with Sarah Centillis, Breaking Up with God, A Love Story. And you wrote, "I'm not post-God. I'm just through thinking about God as a being. And this is what I believe in: mystery, agency, creativity, justice, accountability, love. This is my faith, a fragile hope in what humanity might be able to do when we stop looking for someone else to save us." And I really loved that. It was a sense of not so much losing your faith, but changing the location of it. Is that right? Rather than externally,
exactly
it became
right
here.
That's exactly right. And you've picked my most favorite passage in the book. So thank you for reading that.
Oh, wow.
I think I've taken the faith that I used to have in God and I've invested it in human beings. I want to know. I think I believe that we have everything that we need to make the world a better place. And if you think that when you're trying to make the world a better place, you're doing the work of God, then I think that's a faithful place to be. And I'm hopeful that we can do better. And I think one of the things that happens in some versions of Christianity is this hope that some savior is going to come back and fix everything. But I think we're the savior that we've been waiting for. We're the ones who need to do the work. And for me, that's a hopeful place to be, although sometimes it feels a little bit lonely.
It's kind of bringing the sacred and the holy to earth. That everything we are is sacred. Everything we are, if we want to use the word God, is right here.
Yes. But
tell me about being lonely. Do you still feel lonely? Do you think you and God are going to make up someday? Or
I've gotten emails from people telling me that they think I'm going to get back together with God, that I'm just on this journey, which sometimes I really appreciate and sometimes I find a little bit offensive. But I broke up with a particular understanding of God. I didn't break up with God altogether. I let go of an old way of thinking, and I'm open to new possibilities. I think I'm looking for different understandings, different way to live in an ethical way. And, you know, the word God is out in the world operating. One of the things Gordon used to say to me, Gordon Kaufman, is that asking whether or not God exists is the wrong question, because you've already spoken the word God. God is out there doing all kinds of work. And I'm a scholar of religion. I'm a trained theologian. And I think part of my work is to look at the way God is functioning for good and for bad, and to try to come up with more creative ways to think about God that might do some good for a lot of people. So I consider myself a cultural critic and a theologian still. It's just a little bit tricky because I can't find a home in any institutional space at this point, but I'm not going to say that I never will be able to.
Yeah, that's. I was wondering, you say you have two advanced degrees in theology and no church and the idea of broken up with a personal God. So where has life taken you now?
I'm doing a lot of writing. I mean, I'm finding meaning in writing. I'm working on a novel right now. I'm involved in a project that's examining the intersections of torture and Christianity. I'm working on an edited volume about that. I say in the book that I don't go to church, but I do go to the farmer's market. It's a place where I found a home. I meditate every day. I'm trying to be active in my community, and I just moved to Portland, Oregon, and I'm trying to find a home here, you know, a place that I can feel challenged and held. And so I'm really trying to figure out still what comes next for me. And maybe there's another book project there about where I find faith now.
I like the idea of when you talked about what God does rather than believing in God, which is such a lame question. You're right. But what if we want to talk about God, what is God doing? What is God doing in our lives? You know, farmer's market is no small thing. Food is pretty much a basic for our planet and the survival and care for Earth. I think you're onto something there. And if we could put our energies of religion towards making Earth a more just and sustainable place, that might be a good way to do theology. That's
yeah,
what I
I'm, I'm hopeful about that. I mean, there are a lot of theologians that are doing that kind of work. There's a woman named Sally McFaig who thinks about what if we thought about God as the universe, you know, the earth as the body of God. How would that change how we live and move on this planet? And one of the things that's interesting to me is not what people believe, but what effects their beliefs have. And I think you can believe anything you'd like to believe. I'm not interested in critiquing that. What I'm interested in looking at is how does that make you live? How does it make you move through the world? How does it make you treat other people and animals and the earth? How does it make you think about war? Those kinds of questions. Does it make you a peacemaker or does it make you other people? And that to me is where my energy goes.
And that is the time we have. I've been speaking with Sarah Centilis, author of Breaking Up With God, A Love Story, a book I highly recommend. I want to thank you for your honesty and for sharing that and for sharing with us, in a sense, a taboo topic in some way, one's own faith and talking about God in very honest ways. So thank you for your book and thank you for all your good work.
Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate talking with you.
You've been listening to a 2012 interview with Sarah Centilis, author of Breaking Up With God, A Love Story. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schack. An interview with Eugenie Scott is next. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schack. This episode contains interviews that were originally broadcast in 2012 when the show was called Religion for Life. In October 2012, I broadcast an interview with Eugenie Scott. Eugenie Scott was executive director of the National Center of Science Education in 2012, and she was my guest to discuss the history of the evolution-creationism controversy and promote the teaching of science.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the National Center for Science Education. When was it formed? Why was it formed? And what does it do?
Formed a long time ago by scientists and teachers back in the early 1980s because we were concerned about the introduction into state legislatures all over the country of laws that would require that if a teacher taught evolution, she or he would also have to teach something called creation science, which with not very much examination proved to be a basically biblical literalist theology that was dressed up as science. The science was terrible, and obviously it's a sectarian religious view that doesn't belong in the being advocated in the public schools. So scientists and teachers and civil libertarians and parents and school board members and a lot of people were opposed to these laws. And in organizing to oppose them, we discovered that it was much easier if we banded together, sort of no sense in Tennessee reinventing an approach that had already worked in Minnesota and vice versa. So teachers and scientists and other concerned people banding together managed to stop most of these laws, but two of them did pass, and there were legal decisions down the line about the teaching of creation science. And when the dust settled a couple decades later, the courts had concluded that teaching creation science in the public schools was unconstitutional. But by that time, the National Center for Science Education had gotten organized because even as these bills were working their way through the courts, and even after there had been some decisions striking down creation science, these problems still occurred at the local school board level and at the classroom level, and even from time to time, new legislation promoting some form of creationism emerged at the state level. So there was a continuing need for teachers and scientists and knowledgeable people in general to try to oppose these efforts to compromise the teaching of evolution. Now, the founders of the organization decided to give it a very broad name, like the National Center for Science Education, because they thought that after we've taken care of this creationism problem, that teachers and scientists could work together to improve the teaching of science. But obviously, we're still up to our nostrils in coping with the creationism issues. So that branching out hasn't happened very much. Just this year, though, we decided to take on another issue that is quite parallel to evolution, in the sense that teachers are being pressed to not teach something that has a lot of scientific evidence backing it, and that's global warming. So just this year, we've taken on the issue of climate change as well as evolution, because both of these are topics that teachers get hammered for, even when they are in the state standards and local district curriculum.
My guest, Dr. Eugenie Scott, who is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, is my guest on Religion for Life. She's going to be speaking in Nashville October 27th about the Tennessee Academic Freedom Act. But before we talk about that, Dr. Scott, can you give us a little bit of a history of this conflict in our public schools regarding the teaching of science, particularly evolution and creationism, say, since the Scopes trial in 1925? I mean, as I understood the Scopes trial, he was trying to teach evolution, and it was against the law. So we've come a long way since then.
Yeah, it's a fascinating history, and there are a number of very good histories about this. I have an abbreviated history in my book, Evolution versus Creationism. As you say, the Scopes trial in Tennessee was held back in 1925 because the Tennessee legislature passed a law banning the teaching of evolution, and the ACLU wanted to challenge that law. So John Scopes was willing to be a plaintiff, and whether he actually taught evolution is one of the kind of interesting little historical quirks. He may not have, but nonetheless, he was tried for teaching evolution. People forget, because the Scopes trial was such a huge amount of publicity. I mean, it's a fascinating story. It was the very first legal event, and actually the first event of any kind, I believe, that was carried coast to coast on this newfangled thing called the radio. And a huge percentage of the American public back in 1925 was glued to their radios to listen to the live broadcast of the Scopes trial. It was quite a public phenomenon. And of course, Clarence Darrow, who was the defender of John Scopes and a very controversial public figure, was extremely articulate and made the fundamentalist movement in Tennessee look rather foolish. One of the things that he did was put the William Jennings Bryan, who was the great orator and politician of his day, and he was part of the team that was prosecuting Scopes. Darrow puts Bryan on the stand and questioned him about the Bible. And, there's a lot of things in the Bible that just make no sense if you accept them literally, mm-hmm. like the sun stopping and for Joshua and all that. So, a lot of the biblical literalist point of view was poked great fun at, especially in the press. H.L. Mencken of the Baltimore Sun being notable in his acerbic evaluation of the events of the trial and the Tennessee citizens. But what people kind of forget is, even if it appeared that the Scopes trial was this great victory for modernism, Scopes lost, and these laws stayed on the books. And fairly quickly, even though only a couple of states had passed anti-evolution laws like Tennessee's, fairly quickly textbooks just quietly dropped evolution from their content. And so, according to the historians, from about 1930 on, you would be hard-pressed to find evolution in the high school curriculum. in public schools. Hmm. Well, this changed in the late 50s and early 60s because Sputnik went up and the Russians had beat the U.S. to space, and this was a great black eye to the American pride of superiority in science and so forth. And so the federal government started funding programs that would improve science education and also improve science research, of course. And the committee that was appointed to revise or put out a model high school biology textbook put evolution right back in again, because these the committee members were composed of master teachers and scientists who realized the importance of evolution in the curriculum. So with competent writing of these high school science textbooks, the biology textbooks and geology as well, began including evolution from about the early to mid-1960s on. And evolution also came back into the commercial textbooks because they saw how well the textbooks that had been produced by these government committees worked. And so they started cloning them. And pretty soon, by the early to mid-70s, textbooks regularly included the topic of evolution. Well, this basically stimulated another anti-evolution movement, the aforementioned creation science movement, which became very active in the late 70s in trying to pass laws requiring equal time for creation science and evolution. And this, of course, stimulated, as we began, the origin of the National Center for Science Education. Now, these laws were gradually beaten back by the late 80s, and with creation science no longer legal to be taught, another form of creationism, basically remodeled or sort of creation science light version of creationism called intelligent design, emerged mm-hmm. in the late 80s and early 90s. And by the mid-90s, there were a couple of books on intelligent design, and it was a fairly active movement. By the 2000s, they were also trying to influence the inclusion of intelligent design into the high school curriculum. But the major organization promoting intelligent design, which is the Discovery Institute up in Seattle, started pulling back a little bit in the mid-2000s, arguing not so much for the equal time for intelligent design and evolution, which, of course, was the model that creation science had used. But I think realizing that intelligent design was going to be as legally vulnerable as creation science was, the Discovery Institute proponents started arguing for not teaching ID intelligent design, but teaching instead evolution and the evidence against evolution, or the weaknesses of evolution, or strengths and weaknesses of evolution. They began using this kind of language. And they were wise, of course, to take this track, because, in fact, in 2005, the school board of Dover, Pennsylvania, adopted a policy requiring intelligent design. Parents took them to court. A federal district court judge ruled in late 2005 that intelligent design was just relabeled creation science. Since creation science was unconstitutional, so also was intelligent design, so you can't teach it. But by that time, the intelligent design, organizers and the leaders of the intelligent design movement, if not necessarily the grassroots, had moved on to this weaknesses of evolution or evidence against evolution strategy. Which brings us to your recently passed law last spring.
Yeah, but let's
Senate Bill 893, which is precisely this kind of revamped anti-evolution bill.
Well, let's talk about that in a second. I also want to remind my listeners that I'm speaking with Dr. Eugenie Scott, who is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education. She's talking with me via Skype from Berkeley, California, talking about evolution and creationism. And she just gave a marvelous history of that debate and bringing us up to 2012 and the famous monkey bill, now law in Tennessee. The law known as the Tennessee Academic Freedom Act encourages teachers to present this, quote, scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses, that the language you just had mentioned, of topics that arouse debate and disputation, such as biological evolution, the chemical origins of life, global warming, and human cloning, end quote. So, Dr. Scott, tell us a bit about this law. What will it do? Will it give a pass to teachers to teach creationism?
This bill is very similar to about 40 bills, 40 bills 40. That we've tracked over the last 7 or 8 years. And they often use the same kind of wording. This part, the Tennessee bill is a bundling bill, as we call them, because it's not just evolution. Most of them start out that the early ones were just about evolution, but more recent ones have been bundling evolution with global warming and that other laundry list that you mentioned, origin of life, human cloning. I mean, yeah. How many high school kids study human cloning? Give me a break.
Right.
This is okay, kids. Let's do the lab now. No, I mean, this is not. You know, stem cells is also something that you find in these bills, and these, you know, these topics of cloning and stem cells are not even given passing reference in most high school curricula. So what you're seeing is a list of things that the religious right is really upset about.
Okay.
And that's kind of the fact that you've got these non-curricular items in here is, I think, a good indication of that. So evolution, global warming, origin of life, and these, you know, silly cloning and stem cell topics all together as controversial items. And the way these bills are written is they sound so fair and even-handed. Well, of course, give the students the evidence for, the evidence against, a critical thinking exercise, let them decide, let them weigh the evidence. And, you know, obviously everybody wants kids to be critical thinkers. I mean, who's going to say, no, I want my kid to be dogmatic? I mean, so these bills sound really good.
Even the name of it, Tennessee Academic Freedom Act.
Bingo. They're often billed as giving teachers the freedom to bring new material into the classroom. Except, of course, if a teacher were to bring, for example, evidence that abstinence-based sex education really doesn't work. I wonder how popular that would be. Mm. So there's kind of a short list of things that teachers are given this academic freedom to do. And you know, actually, John, we should just take a moment to reflect on that for a minute, because just like critical thinking, our fellow citizens are also quite positive about academic freedom. Academic freedom is a good thing. But when you think about it, academic freedom is something that applies really at the post-secondary or university college level. At the kindergarten through 12th grade level, you know, they really don't have much academic freedom, and there's a reason for it. If you're running a K-12 school district and you've got, say you're teaching high school history or high school math or high school biology or English or something, you want to have continuity across the classrooms. Mm-hmm. You want the teachers teaching English to teach the same stuff. You want the chemistry teachers to teach the same stuff. You don't want one chemistry teacher teaching, cold fusion, okay? And right. The other chemistry teachers are teaching straight-up chemistry. And so basically, at the K-12 level, when a teacher signs a contract to teach in Nashville or Berkeley or wherever, the teacher is agreeing to teach the curriculum of that district. And you want it to be that way. You don't want a whole lot of freelancing. You don't want teachers just teaching what they think is a good idea to teach, because you want that continuity from class to class at the K-12 level. Now, at the university level, it's different. you do have academic freedom, and academic freedom really doesn't mean you teach anything you want anyway. Academic freedom is much more carefully constrained than that. There is a truth in advertising. If it's a math class, you really should be teaching math. You shouldn't be teaching, you know, French poetry. But just the same, you want to have that continuity at the K-12 level. So K-12 teachers really don't have academic freedom in the sense that most people think about it. So these bills sound really good, but if you know the history of this movement, if you know the history of these bills, it's very clear that these are just ways of trying to get creationism into the classroom through a back door. And that's because if you look at the wording of the bills, they talk about the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. Now, I'll bet if any of your listeners go to their local university biology department and say, "Hello, Dr. Brown, would you please give me a list of the weaknesses of evolution so that I can take it to my high school teacher?" He'll just look at you like, "What?" Yeah. He won't know what you're talking about. There is no list of weaknesses of evolution. The only place where you can find the alleged weaknesses of evolution is if you go to the creationist literature. And there you get a lot of really bad science. You get things like gaps in the fossil record disprove evolution, or the second law of thermodynamics disproves evolution. And these things that just make, scientists, slap their palms against their foreheads because it just, this is just nonsense that has been refuted decades ago. But these ideas are still recycled and recycled and recycled by creationists because, basically, since they can't teach biblical creationism, the best thing they can do is attack evolution, present a lot of bad science that's only found in the creationist literature, so that students will believe that evolution is a weak or discredited idea, and then the students themselves will sort of automatically say, "Oh, well, if evolution didn't happen, then God did it." Mostly because they don't really understand modern Christian theology. But that is the kind of dichotomous thinking that creationists have and that, frankly, most kids have because they really don't know any better.
Dr. Eugenie Scott, my guest on Religion for Life. She is the executive director for the National Center for Science Education. And one of the phrases that's often used is teach the controversy, which is a similar type of thing. But there really is no controversy. I mean, we just should spell this out from a scientific point of view, is there?
That's correct. And that is the distinction that most people don't appreciate. There's a social controversy over evolution, but really there's no scientific controversy over whether living things have common ancestors. And we even have lots of agreement on the pattern of evolution, how the tree of life is branched through time, and the major mechanisms. Now, scientists obviously are going to argue about the details, but that's not the kind of controversy that Teach the Controversy is about. Teach the Controversy really is translated as pretend to students that scientists are arguing about evolution, and that's really miseducating them.
Okay, because there is none. Now, what about the practicality of this law and the other 40 you mentioned that are like that?
The vast majority of the other 40 have not passed. Our allies on the grounds in all the states fighting these have managed to stop them in committee or keep them from becoming law. Only your state and Louisiana have passed these academic freedom laws.
Okay, so what's going to happen to us?
We're going to try to encourage people to do in Tennessee, and I encourage anybody listening to this program who wants to help to contact me at scott@ncse.com. We have a model resolution that we're going to present next month to Tennessee citizens that we hope that citizens will take to their local school district. And the resolution is along the lines of, we, the school district XYZ, the Board of Education of the school district XYZ, will direct our teachers to do such and such. And what teachers are going to be encouraged to do is, as they implement this law, that they teach the consensus view of science. In other words, quite frankly, it's a way of working around the law in a way that reflects the fact that this law has been passed. But there are many ways that this law can be implemented at the local school district level, including strengthening the teaching of good science. Okay. Now, what we're worried about and what citizens of Tennessee are worried about is that this law will instead be used to bring creationism in by the back door. So if citizens would be willing to take this resolution to their local school boards, we could get a movement going in Tennessee that I think would help to head off the worst of this this bill, which potentially has some real drawbacks.
And that resolution is on your website, ncse.com?
It will be shortly.
Okay. So National Center for Science Education, www.ncse.com.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, in addition to evolution and creationism, climate change is now on your agenda from this past year of teaching it, and it has become controversial in this social sense as well. But again, scientists are what's the consensus regarding scientists and climate change?
You know, the scientists as a whole, according to survey research data on scientists at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the largest general science organization, 90% of them agreed that the planet's getting warmer and people's activities have a lot to do with it, what's called anthropogenic global warming. If you survey just climate scientists, it's up in the high 90s. So in terms of the scientific community, these two principles, it's getting warmer and people have a lot to do with it, that you know, the generation of CO2 is a major driver of the current very rapid rate of climate change. These are in strong agreement in the scientific community. But because largely not so much of religious ideology, but of political ideology and economic ideology, these views are being strongly opposed by a number of, unfortunately, quite well-funded organizations, which are trying to convince the public that the evidence for global warming is inadequate.
So it's kind of an interesting banding of religious conservatives or religious fundamentalists and political conservatives and economic global corporations working together, all making the language, in a sense, of that bill that was passed into law in Tennessee.
Very true. Very true. These bills are usually sponsored by people who identify with the religious right, which is that intersection of religious conservatives and political conservatives. So the anti-evolution part comes from the religious conservatism, but the anti-global warming part comes from the political conservatism. Because after all, there are evangelicals who are green Christians, who are, you know, with stewardship theology. They believe that God has told us to take care of the earth, and so they accept global warming, and they're really working hard to, you know, to oppose the kinds of policies that that promote more carbon use. And there certainly are political conservatives who accept evolution. So it's really that kind of interesting religious right intersection that seems to be behind these bills. And that's a minority.
Right, right.
And it's important that the public realize that the majority really needs to speak up on this.
You've been listening to a special encore presentation of Progressive Spirit featuring interviews from 2012 when the show was called Religion for Life. Catch over 300 interviews with scholars, activists, and authors who have something to say about social justice, spirituality, human flourishing, and things that matter on ProgressiveSpirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, I'm John Schuck. Be well.